My childhood fascination was American Indians. When I was 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, I wanted to grow up to be an Indian. My mother did her best to convince me that was not possible, since I'm half Ukrainian and half Pennsylvania Dutch. You know, this is not Apache, Comanche, or Navajo. But then when I went to the seminary, St. Vladimir Seminary in Westchester County, New York, I discovered that there were Native Americans who were also Orthodox Christians. I didn't know anything about that until I was maybe 20-something years old. And I decided, here are two of my lifelong interests united on American soil. I don't even need a passport to get there. And so I sort of resolved, someday I'm going to go to Alaska. And at the end of my first semester in seminary, a letter came from Alaska inviting someone, they didn't care who, to come to Kodiak Island to do Aleut school. So I volunteered, and it was love at first sight, and I've been here pretty much ever since. What I came to realize about my students, and this is now 35 years ago, is that they did not see the world the same way I did. The anecdote that I tell in my class about that is the word animal. For English-speaking people, an animal is a living thing of inferior intelligence and sensitivity. For Native Americans, traditionally, an animal is a living thing of superior intelligence and sensitivity. Animals see things we can't see, hear things we can't hear, smell and sense things we can't detect. They know things we don't know. And they're in cahoots. So that if the moose doesn't hear you coming with his big ears or smell you coming with his big nose, the magpies have already tipped him off. So you live in a world where the human beings are on probation, you could say, or under surveillance, and the animals are watching how we act and how we behave and determining whether or not to allow us to catch them. In traditional Yupik and Aleutic culture, a hunter only succeeds if the animal allows itself to be caught. It's a gift. The animals give themselves to people who are respectful and humble and grateful and who treat their weapons appropriately, who skin and kill their prey in a respectful way, who cook and eat the food in the respectful and traditional way, and who even dispose of the garbage, you could say, the leftovers, in the appropriate and respectful way. Such people will be rewarded by the gift of more food. Those who are wasteful or disrespectful will go hungry. And I had no sense that that's what animal meant to my fourth graders when I came to the village. Only hearing the stories that they heard about the animals from their grandparents did I come to realize that their way of seeing their ecosystem and relating to it was totally different from the way I perceived it when I first arrived. And little by little, when you realize if the animals are such a different reality, then eating and good manners are different. And if the animals give themselves to the hunter, then hunting is a very different enterprise. It's a very serious and one could say even sacred activity. It's not a recreational sport. So I say hunting, you say hunting, we both speak English. Why aren't we connecting? And the answer I eventually defined as my students did not see the world the same way I did. But my students were all speaking English. They were all wearing Eddie Bauer parkas and Nike Keds, the externals indicated that they were the same as Anglo kids in any other part of the world, at least any other part of the United States. But in fact, the longer I lived there, the more I came to realize that was just superficial. And culture is, culture continues a lot longer than you realize. And then I reflected on my own family, my Pennsylvania German ancestors. Settled in a neighborhood that was still, when I was born, heavily populated by people whose ancestors had also come from Germany. None of them spoke German. But when I visited Germany 20 years later, I realized how German our neighborhood still was. They were highly focused on hygiene, cleanliness, and punctuality, probably more than any other cultural expression. Things should be neat, things should be tidy, and things should happen on schedule, on time. And then you go to Germany and you meet 80 million people who behave that way. So there was nothing strange about my neighborhood except they were still, after two centuries in America, behaving in a very Germanic way. And my father, who was Ukrainian, I came to appreciate him all the more visiting Russia and Ukraine, because then I met 100 million people who behaved just like my dad, completely oblivious to punctuality and never concerned about being on time. So my mother used to say, "There's something wrong with your father," whenever we were late. But that was her German ancestry speaking through her mouth, so to speak. And my father's lack of concern for punctuality was coming directly out of his ancestral culture several generations after his ancestors came to America. So I realized that, upon reflection, cultural behaviors and cultural attitudes, cultural beliefs, the ball game of life as you play it, is another way of discussing culture. That ballgame doesn't change even when the language changes. A whole lot of things get passed on. Attitudes, beliefs, behaviors get passed on from generation to generation, even when the ancestral language is no longer the main medium of communication. And when I realized that was true for my mother after three or four generations and my father after only two, of course it's going to be true for my Aleutic kids on Kodiak Island, who are still in their home village. They haven't even left home. They're still where their ancestors have been for 7,000 years. They're going to behave like and think like their ancestors, like Aleutics always have for thousands of years, even though they're eating pizza and you know, at that time and listening to the Beatles, because their way of seeing their ballgame of life hasn't really radically changed. And getting that across to newcomers is often difficult because they want to believe that kids are kids are kids, that these kids are eating the same food, listening to the same music, wearing the same clothes as the kids we left behind in Kansas. Therefore, what the way we taught in Kansas is going to work, you know, in Cuitlok, and it's not. And when things break down, the tragedy then is that most professionals blame the local people. Something went wrong and it wasn't me, so it has to be them. And you wind up with a kind of downward spiral in which the whole relationship with the community deteriorates. And then those professional people leave, and we get another batch of rookies, and we do it again. So I'm very much concerned about that. I would like to see that paradigm broken. I would like to see people coming into the state trained, professionally trained, before they enter into their profession. I would like to see teachers certified on a regional basis instead of statewide. I would like to see people going into Southeast Alaska take a college course or two in Tlingit language and culture and history. We have the materials to do that at a very high level. And so they understand and actually welcome and appreciate the opportunity to live among Tlingit people. And if they're going to go into the interior to have the same kind of background, so we can send them to Minto or Anaktuvik Pass, well, that's in the Inupiaq village, or Arctic village, or Alakakit, with some enthusiasm for moving into an uniquely Athabascan culture and to know something about that and to be able to appreciate that. And if they come out here to the Aleutian Islands, they should know something about the remarkable history of the Unangan people and be enthusiastic and eager to know more and to relate to their students and their parents and their and those grandparents, to get involved in the community and develop a sense of respect and rapport that has seldom happened, actually. I would say rather sadly, but seldom happens, because people are coming through for such brief tours of duty and then going on. We often have Native Alaskans say, "Well, you know, we really don't have a history of succeeding in school." And if you go back into the 19th century, it turns out there was phenomenal success in school, but they were schools that took the local language and culture into the curriculum. If you read only the established English language histories of Alaska, the Russian period, the entire 130 years or so, is characterized by violence and enslavement. But upon closer examination, the violence and enslavement happened under Alexander Baranov's regime between 1791 and 1818. Those 27 years were definitely a time of enslavement and violence, of the involuntary drafting of Native people into company service, the relocation of thousands of Native men to different parts of the North Pacific, as far east as the Kuril Islands, just north of Hokkaido, Japan, and as far south as Sonoma County, California. So the islands were depopulated, not because everybody died, but because literally thousands were relocated under Baranov's rule to do the company manual labor. And then eventually, with the schools founded in the next decades, that population were educated to take over and actually run those enterprises. And in the following generation, they were pretty much running the show. Alaska from 1840 or 50 onward, well past the sale of 1867, was basically run by Aleut people. They were running the stores. They were mapping the coastlines. Most of Alaska was mapped by Aleut cartographers, men who were trained in Kodiak or Sitka, some of them even at Kronstadt near St. Petersburg, in mapping. And they were building the ships and mapping the coastlines, producing the nautical charts of the harbors. It was all being done by Native Alaskan Alutiiq and Unangan men and women who were running their own schools. Almost all the trading posts on the mainland were operated by Aleut people, who by that time had intermarried with Yupik and Athabascan wives. It's just a remarkable story that's the last 50 years of the Russian period and completely omitted in the history books as we teach history. Most people, most newcomers, certainly would not be aware that among the Aleut people, there was a trilingual school system in place that Aleuts themselves were operating across the entire state, beginning in the 1850s and 60s and continuing until 1917. The money to fund these schools came from a mission society in Russia, who were still concerned with Alaska Native people because there had been 127 years of mutual interaction. And there were people from Unalaska and Kodiak who were college graduates, tri- and quadrilingual people who could read, write, and speak three and four languages. They were running their own schools, publishing their own books, sailing their own ships, running their own businesses. Kodiak was 90% Native at the time of the sale of Alaska. And Sitka, the capital, was two-thirds Native. There were never more than 800 Russian citizens in Alaska at any one time. And most of the people we called Russian weren't ethnic Slavs at all. They were citizens of the Russian Empire, and they spoke the Russian language, but they were Native people from Siberia. Lydia Black discovered that over a third of the Russians who came to Alaska were, in fact, Natives from the Kamchatka Peninsula, Kamchadal. So what looks like a European intrusion into North America turns out to be an interaction between the Native people on one side with the Native people on this side. The Slavic surnames and a lot of the Slavic heritage in this southwest quadrant of Alaska was actually introduced by an interaction between Native peoples. Of course, the Siberian Natives often had some measure of Slavic ancestry, but it wasn't a bunch of tall, blonde, blue-eyed white guys coming into Alaska in the 1740s, 50s, 60s. It was Native people interacting with and in large numbers intermarrying with Unangan people. And they raised children who were bilingual, and the kids went to schools. The first Native schools were here on Alaska. St. Innocent Veniaminoff, the parish priest here, devised the Unangan alphabet, printed the first books. And within a century, it was Unangan people, in fact, who were pretty much running the show, sailing the ships even around the world. In 1978, when I discovered that there were Aleut sea captains sailing company ships around the tip of South America and suspiciously stopping for lengthy R&R in Rio, and I published this, my findings were rejected by university professors at the university and by scholars at the Library of Congress. They said, that's preposterous. Everybody knows the Aleuts were nothing but slaves to the Russians and there were no such people, there were no such ships and so forth. I said, well, check my footnotes. And they did. Some poor guy had to reconfirm all my research going back to Russian archives and such and discovered that I was telling the truth, that this was a whole aspect of Alaska history that had been ignored until then, at least. I think it's a fascinating and ignored chapter of Alaska history. From St. Innocent was here in the Aleutian chain in the 1820s and 30s, but he started the school system that trained local leadership. The same thing happened on Kodiak Island in Aleutiiq a little bit earlier. And so out of this educational system that began during the Russian period and continued into the American period for at least another 50 years. There were artists, portraitists, that is, musicians. Aleut Chamber Orchestra in Sitka was playing Mozart and Beethoven stuff in the governor's mansion back in the 1830s and 40s. Sea captains, the shipyard was at Seward and then later Sitka. There was one Kashavarov, Alexander Kashavarov, a graduate of the school here, who went on to the Russian Naval Academy in the Baltic, sailed around the world several times, was promoted to the rank of major general in the Russian military, and when he retired, moved to St. Petersburg. And so I've had students, especially Native Alaskan students, burst into tears and run out of my room after I've told them something that was basically true about their home region or their ancestors. And when I go to console this, I remember one woman in particular from Kodiak, she said, I took Alaska history, and when I brought these topics up, my professor said, that was all untrue. Your grandma didn't know what she was talking about. And now I'm taking your class and you're telling me the opposite. My grandmother was telling the truth. She did know what she was talking about was true, and it was the professor I took the class from who was in error, and it's the books that are wrong, and my ancestors were right. And I said, yeah, that's exactly what I'm telling you. And then I was invited to the Alaska Federation of Natives, and they gave me a nice plaque and a dentalia necklace, the insignia of an Athabascan elder. And as Willie Hensley, who's a Nupiak, of course, put this dentalia necklace around my neck, he said, I guess we're going to have to call you from now on Chief Father Michael. Everyone laughed, and I called my mother and said, guess what, Ma? I got to be an Indian chief after all.